But I really don't have any regrets. I really don't. I've lived exactly how I've wanted to. I've tried my hardest every single time. I didn't win the matches that maybe I should have always won, but I really gave it my all, so that for me is enough.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Body Serve. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm James.
This is a whopper of an episode. It kept building and building and building over the last couple of days. This is probably 3 episodes worth of material distilled into one.
It is, yeah. And we're trying to fit it in between earth-shaking events. I'm sure by the time we finish recording, there'll be something else to talk about. So, you know, it might not be time sensitive, and we're just going to have to deal with that.
There's a lot of stuff happening outside the tennis lines, be tennis related or the socio-political racial unrest in America that's affecting the tennis. And then there is the segue between recapping the Western and Southern Open which happened in New York, and previewing the US Open, which starts on Monday.
And then there's also the small thing about the formation of a breakaway players association.
Is it a union? Is it a players association? What exactly is it? We're here to tell you, we don't know. Does anybody know? Do they know? In formatting this episode, we decided to go with a linear, chronological telling of the events of the last few days. And so while the PTPA, the Professional Tennis Players Association, is the news that's on everybody's tongue right now, that will feature toward the end of the episode, which then segues into the US Open mini preview.
Right. So let's begin with where we were in the beginning of the week with more unrest in the United States caused by just another chapter in this continuum of state-sponsored racist violence that, you know, we've been seeing for the past several centuries.
We came to you with an episode earlier in quarantine having to do with how the tennis players in the tennis world was reacting to the murder of George Floyd. And a lot of those protests are still happening around the United States. And then on top of that, we had another incident of police violence, of police shooting an unarmed black man to further stoke those flames.
Right. The protests have receded from kind of the front page news over the past few weeks, but they're still very much going on. And they have intensified over the past week, largely because of the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. He was unarmed. You know, don't need to get into the whole details because you can read about it yourself. But he was shot 7 times in the back by a police officer. He miraculously survived, but he is paralyzed. 2 officers have been placed on administrative leave. And Blake was reportedly handcuffed to his hospital bed despite being paralyzed below the waist.
And despite not having committed a crime. Really?
They say resisting arrest would be his crime.
I can't even begin to get into that.
Yeah, the proportionality of that response.
Having to maintain some mirage of justification after the fact to then handcuff this man while he's fighting for his life in an ICU.
So protests have erupted all over the place, but in Kenosha especially. On Tuesday, a 17-year-old white supremacist terrorist armed with an AR-15 shot and killed 2 protesters while police officers watched.
He wasn't even arrested on the scene. He was able to walk through the crowd, walk by police officers, and was subsequently arrested elsewhere.
Yeah, so we've been seeing this more and more. At a lot of Black Lives Matter protests, there's counter-protesters showing up in military regalia holding assault weapons, and they're treated differently by police officers than BLM protesters.
In this instance, it seemed like these militias were coordinated with to suppress the Black Lives Matter protesters.
On Facebook.
Yeah.
Anyway, on Wednesday afternoon, the Milwaukee Bucks refused to take the court in protest of the shooting of Jacob Blake and the response, and of course the long history of state violence against Black people. The Bucks were the first team, but not the only team, to make this move. They were followed by Orlando, Portland, Houston, OKC, the Lakers, all teams which refused to play in the playoffs that day. And it's important to note that the WNBA has been at the forefront of these types of protests really from the beginning. WNBA players also refused to take the court, but not before marching out on court in t-shirts that spelled out Jacob Blake's name with 7 gunshots painted on the back of the t-shirts.
With respect to the professional basketball players, men and women, this is something that they've been doing for months. They have been at the forefront of these protests led by professional athletes across all sports. They have been the leaders. And so it became clear with this latest incident that what they were doing before wasn't enough to effect change. And so they then started to organize within themselves to try and figure out a way to actually get something meaningful done that will cause some change to this ongoing situation.
Right. And the most meaningful thing they could do is withdraw their labor. They refuse to play. They are the money. They're the entertainment. And it becomes very clear that Black people are seen in American culture as safe when they're entertainers, when they're athletes. When they become political actors, you get shut up and dribble or keep politics out of sports. Like, things all of a sudden become much more charged and much more impactful when Black athletes assert their full humanity.
They're supposed to create the culture that then gets pilfered and stolen. They're supposed to entertain you, to take your minds off of whatever is going on in your life, all the while putting aside their own personal, emotional angst.
Mm-hmm. There's one Black president of an NBA team. That's Masai Ujiri of the Toronto Raptors. You still have this big problem with front office, with the C-suite being largely white, and the workforce, or the athletes themselves, being largely Black. And this works a different way in tennis, right? The leadership in tennis is very white, but the players are also largely still white European or American players.
Clearly, we've had some game-changing Black athletes throughout the history of tennis. But by and large, the majority at all levels of the sport, while there have been some improvements, is a large majority white. And even though you have Masai Ujiri as president of the Toronto Raptors, we still see that he is just another Black man in the United States, with what happened to him right after the Toronto Raptors won the NBA championship last year. Video of that just resurfaced as well.
Look that up if you're not familiar. Being manhandled and harassed by an off-duty police officer who was working as security.
He was accused of assault. The video emerges now where you see that Ujiri is about to show or reaching for his credential to present it. It's in his coat pocket, and he is the one who is attacked.
Yeah.
The NBA players, when this strike occurred and we were told that there weren't going to be any basketball games that day, a lot of the response was, well, what is this going to achieve? And we saw what that achieved, because the players wanted to get as much as they could from their owners to be a part of this process. Throughout this entire agitation from the basketball players, it's been on them. They've been the ones leading the charge. Meanwhile, you have these billionaire owners, these 30 billionaire owners, who are doing nothing. They have such social reach, such social capital that they could deploy to aid this issue. Think of just how connected those men are, all of them. And so the basketball players said, well, you know what? You all have to step up to the plate. No, you want us to play? You want us to step and fetch it and create all these dollars for you? Well, step up to the plate. And it turns out that the result was quite meaningful. All 30 NBA arenas, well, I guess 29, I'm not sure about the Scotiabank Arena.
Oh.
So 28 then, because it's the same for the Lakers and the Clippers. They will be used as polling places on election day, which is huge, given that the GOP is doing so much work to restrict access to the ballot in November. As to how this relates to tennis, Naomi Osaka decides ahead of her semifinal, which should have happened on Thursday at the Western and Southern Open, that she was not gonna play. She decided that this was one of the ways that she could meaningfully take action to create and start a conversation in tennis.
She posted on her social media accounts on Wednesday evening a note. She said, "Before I am an athlete, I am a Black woman. And as a Black woman, I feel as though there are much more important matters at hand that need immediate attention, rather than watching me play tennis." She went on to say that she was pulling out of her semifinal. She would not play tomorrow. It was kind of like The tournament can do what they want, but I will not be there tomorrow.
And what the tournament decided, in conjunction with the WTA and the ATP, was that, well, you know what? We're going to take steps to support you, Naomi, and show that we are listening.
Right. So imagine the rushed conversations that were going on Wednesday night after she dropped this, because she acted alone. This wasn't in coordination with anyone. This wasn't like she tipped off the tournament and WTA, like, hey, this is what I'm going to do, so figure it out. This was Naomi taking a principled stand where she had something material to lose.
I've seen a lot of cynical responses, and the same responses have been applied to NBA players. Well, they're millionaires. They have nothing to lose. They're the ones who have nothing to lose. Well, okay.
Okay.
Who is doing anything if not these players?
Like, she can't help now that she's a millionaire.
She is the highest paid woman athlete in the world. This is something that's new. This is something that became known at the start of quarantine, if I recall correctly. And she is sat there with this knowledge, this newfound status in global sport, seeing what's happened in the United States, where she spent most of her life, where she trains, where on her way from Florida to California, at the height of the George Floyd protests, she stopped off in Minneapolis to see what was happening for herself on the ground. She told us that she used that quarantine time to educate herself, to find her voice. And this was something that she felt she had to do.
She released a statement in both English and Japanese. She mentioned, not in the statement, but she's spoken about her father being Haitian and that being a big influence on her, saying that we don't stay quiet about these things.
She said in her interview with Chris McKendry on ESPN2, this is what we do. Haitians. And Chris was like, well, what do you mean by that? Hello?
Right. Well, it's a valid follow-up.
Yeah, it is.
You know,
it
can
is,
you please it? Expand yeah. on that? You know, every time Naomi takes an action like this, you see the multiplicitous, pardon the pretentious word, the nature of her identity, right? She's Japanese, she's Haitian, but she very much grew up as an American girl. So she has all these aspects of her identity, and those parts of her identity are often criticized, picked apart from those different countries that she hails from, right?
People are always wanting to say that various parts of her identity are inauthentic or not enough.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you are not American enough, you are not Japanese enough, you're not Black enough. And so when she's taking this stance for Black Lives Matter, when folks want her to just shut up and serve, they immediately go to, well, aren't you Japanese? Like, why are you doing
right.
this?
Didn't you choose Japanese citizenship when you had the chance? It's just, she has, over the past few years, reasserted many times her identity as a Black woman, right? That's a part of her identity that she owns and that she's proud of. And she's very much stepped into that. I mean, for a long time. Obviously, I'm not qualified to speak on that. But politically, she has really asserted herself a lot over the past few months, which we know. What was impressive about this week is just how big that influence is. Naomi said, stop the world, and the world stopped. Tennis world literally stopped.
You're wrong there. I don't think Naomi knew the full reach of her influence. Naomi said, I will stop, and I will take this individual decision that I will bear the repercussions of and hope to make change. But she did not know the ripple effects of it, I don't think.
By the end of the night, this is Wednesday, the WTA and the Western and Southern Open and the ATP announced a pause in play. They said, we will not play at all on Thursday. And they said, quote, tennis is collectively taking a stance against racial inequality and social injustice. It came out the next day that, okay, yeah, we're going to play again on Friday. Everything is going to be pushed back a day. Naomi decided to play. And of course, people were like, huh? Some people were annoyed by it, saying that she kind of rescinded what she said the previous day. And to be clear, she never said she was withdrawing for the tournament. She was saying, I will not play on Thursday.
See, that became so muddied and chaotic for no reason. Like, okay, yes, you read into her original statement, she's withdrawing from the tournament. But that social media post is not an official withdrawal from the tournament.
Right.
you can say what you want on social media, but you actually have to physically, through, I don't know exactly what the measure is, contacting which office.
Mm. But it's like, is that your final answer?
Exactly. So for somebody to then say, well, she already said she was withdrawing on Instagram, so how is she here? Come on. Let's do better than that.
And she also couldn't predict what the tournament and the league's response was going to be.
Mm-hmm. WTA CEO Steve Simon immediately reaches out and, according to Naomi, says that he was incredibly supportive and they then worked behind the scenes, because obviously the WTA has a vested interest, as does the tournament, in Naomi continuing to play this event.
Yeah. And the semifinals and final actually occurring.
Yes. And with those negotiations and with the tournament and both tours agreeing to take the day off in recognition of this moment of crisis in American society, she then decided to continue on in the tournament.
She was satisfied that her protest created a conversation, had an impact, and that impact will continue.
Mm-hmm.
So she decided to play.
It's important to note that the progress that basketball has made, the amount of time that conversation has already been happening, has not been the case in tennis.
Right,
at all.
Right.
So to compare the net result of this pause in play between basketball and tennis and what Naomi was able to get done as opposed to the basketball players is not fair to her.
Right. The writer Howard Bryant described the NBA as the most revolutionary of America's major sports historically. And, you know, he talked about the WNBA and Naomi Osaka's direct action here. And the interesting thing is that women's tennis, not tennis in general, but women's tennis specifically, is historically highly politicized, right? It may not be revolutionary from the outside looking in, but shut up and dribble or shut up and serve doesn't work in tennis. Because throughout the past 50 years, being a women's tennis player has always been bigger. The personal has always been political if you are a female athlete, but especially a female tennis player, because you have a legacy of labor organizing. You have Billie Jean King, the Williams sisters, all of these trailblazers who not only opened up new arenas, but they had to fight like at every turn, right? And note that when we look back at all of the political activists in tennis history, we list a lot of women. We list one man.
Arthur Ashe.
One. I mean, sometimes you may see Yannick Noah on the list, but that's pretty much it, right? You see Billie Jean King, Martina Navratilova, Renee Richards, the Williams sisters, Pam Shriver. I mean, the list goes on and on. Women's tennis players have been politically engaged because it was, I mean, politics sort of defined their existence as a league, right? If women's tennis players weren't political, they would still be making 1/10 the prize money as men. They'd, I don't know, probably still be wearing long dresses.
You have here noted on the agenda, please know that men are more frequently an impediment to political action in tennis, ... Infer what you will about the present moment.
Yes, please do. But men's tennis has historically been more conservative. And what I mean by more conservative is that they have had a vested interest in holding up the institutions as they already exist, because they were built to benefit men. Men's tennis has been more resistant to activism, not necessarily labor organizing, because we saw a ton of that in the 60s and 70s, a lot of turmoil in men's tennis, but men's tennis has not birthed that many great activists, people who are willing to speak passionately about issues outside of the sport.
On our episode, What's the Point of the WTA If We Don't Stick Together?, we spoke about how for the first few years of the WTA, Arthur Ashe was very much against equal prize money. And so what that says to me, and it's something I expand further into society and how I see men operate politically, the bottom line is always self-preservation of their sex first.
So I think you see this in the current organizing drive for the Professional Tennis Players Association. Equal prize money for women is very often seen as a direct loss for men, even if there's no material loss. Any sort of creation of pay equity is seen as a loss. However, men's tennis has frequently been the beneficiary of gains made by women.
Mm-hmm.
Billie Jean King became a superstar, one of the biggest celebrities in the United States, not even just sports, in the early 70s with the Battle of the Sexes.
Tennis became the most popular it had ever been in the United States shortly after that.
Right.
And if you can't make the correlation between what Billie Jean King did with the WTA and that Battle of the Sexes and that happening and the explosion of access to tennis for young women, I don't know what to tell you.
Right. The point is, the popularity of tennis waxes and wanes, and sometimes men's tennis is much more popular than women's and vice versa. But overall, women tennis players have often had to bear the burden of being organizers and being activists, and the men's side of things have often benefited from that activism while not taking an active role in it, which we'll talk about a little bit later.
Or even acknowledging that they have benefited from it.
Right, or working tirelessly against it. While all this is going on, you know, the Western Southern Open is happening. This is a Masters event on the men's side. It typically happens in Cincinnati. It's one of the most important events of the summer, and it's happened under very strange circumstances.
Uh-huh. The winners, you may have guessed before the week started that Novak Djokovic would have won, and he did. What you would not have guessed is that Victoria Azarenka would have won the women's title. And if you had listened to our previous episode, where we croaked on about what was missing and lacking in Vika's game in her attempted comeback to former glory.
It was mostly me.
I did it too. I mean, it just goes to show when it comes to like tennis, actual tennis analysis, like just don't listen to us.
Well, listen, we will always admit when we're wrong or try. A lot of people have been saying the same thing.
It doesn't give me any more comfort to be wrong en masse with other people.
No, but I'm saying like that's, I don't think that's a weakness of our show uniquely.
Oh, you know? Okay.
But Victoria Azarenka, she hasn't won successive matches since last summer, right? Since Cincinnati last year.
She hasn't won a title since 2016. All that we said last week about her game lacking teeth, not being able to be consistent enough in points, to being bullied around, to not having any power to her game. Look, she was hitting aces all week. She was hanging firm from the baseline, hitting down the line, doing all the things that we remember Vika doing. And yeah, she's back.
Right. It was a huge turnaround from last week. Albeit we only saw her briefly during her first match against Venus Williams. She begins this week by beating number 15, Donna Vekic, beats Garcia, Cornet, Anshabur, Joanna Konta, who's been having a great week and excels on these quick hard courts, and finally reaches the final after a stoppage in play on Thursday, is to face Naomi Osaka, and Naomi gives a walkover because of a hamstring injury that she sustained during her semifinal with Elisa Mertens. Do we worry about the hamstring, by the way? Is this a...
It's so low on the list of things, right? To worry about.
There's
right now.
So many other things going on that this injury has really flown under the radar. Some other things happened this week in Cincinnati/New York City. Riley Opelka reached his first Masters quarterfinal, beating Schwartzman and Berrettini before falling to Tsitsipas in a retirement. Dominic Thiem, who played 28 matches during quarantine, wins only 3 games in his match to Krajinovic.
This one was juicy for me. Real juicy.
It was surprising, I have to say. Krajinovic played excellent tennis this week.
I didn't allow myself to be surprised because other emotions filled
okay,
my reaction fine. Space.
Alexander Zverev lost to Sir Andrew Murray. I will remind you that Zverev said, after quarantine, you're going to know who worked hard during the break and who didn't. I guess now we know.
Didn't work hard enough on his serve, apparently.
Honestly, I have trouble taking pleasure in that because there's clearly a serving yips problem. And we've seen that sort of follow players throughout their entire careers.
It's not about taking pleasure. It's about taking a jab. A little jab. You run your mouth. You leave yourself susceptible to a jab. It's as simple as that.
Fair enough. Miloš Raonic,
new hair. What a week.
New hair, new thighs. Or maybe he's just showing them off more.
The cut of the short is different.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, I came home from work one day this week and he was playing a night match. And I just stood in front of the TV for a good 5 minutes trying to process what I was watching. Mm-hmm. I was like, where did this proportional thickness and correct short length come from with Milos?
I don't know. He came out of quarantine with a John McEnroe headband with this big head of curly hair, short shorts. He looks muscular. Like he looks like a big dude now.
He is a big dude.
But he looks like very sturdy.
I had tweeted, I have never looked at Milos Raonic the way I have tonight. For many reasons.
I don't know how to feel about it yet, but...
One of them was like, wow, this is a whole meal I'm looking at. And I got a lot of responses with folks just completely mesmerized. Not just that night, but historically by Milos Raonic's legs.
Yeah, I didn't know this was a thing, really, until now.
And then I cast my mind's eye back to being on Court 10. It may have been Court 9 at the time, but no, Court 10 in Cincinnati. That great outer court. And I'm so close to the players watching it. And I'd never been that close to Milos playing a tennis match. And I was mesmerized. He is, as a physical specimen, and this is not even a sexual thing, he is captivating to look at. So it's... If you had told me I'd be spending 3 to 5 minutes on this on my own tennis podcast at any point, I would have been shocked. But here we are. And the other reason why I hadn't looked at Milos the way I did that night was because later on that night, he was presented with Naomi Osaka's withdrawal from the Western and Southern Open. And on the fly, off the cuff, he had incredible supportive words to offer her.
Right. Didn't even know what had happened, hadn't read the post, but was immediately supportive of what she was standing for. And he even spoke out about Black Lives Matter in his runner-up speech today.
After his match where he beat Tsitsipas, he wrote BLM on the camera.
So in the final today, he wins the first set against Novak 6-1. Novak, unsurprisingly, wins in three sets. He had a number of miracle recoveries this week, Novak. Amazing. Well, I don't even, honestly...
Don't bait me into that.
Honestly, I really don't even care about, like, not making Novak fans angry because Novak has really asked for it over the past few months. The histrionics are back, and it's too much. It's too much. So Novak won his 35th Masters title, tying Rafa with the most ever. He's won at least two at each of the Masters, and that's that. I mean, he's going to win the US Open, so everybody just get ready for it.
I mean, he's a favorite. I don't know that it's inevitable.
I feel it's inevitable.
Okay. I think that sweltering heat, playing five sets against the right opponent, it might not be as inevitable as you think.
Okay.
Keep in mind, Rafa's won more US Opens than he has.
I would just say, like, prepare yourself. Amazing that this is no longer a story, but Serena Williams meets Maria Sakkari in, I guess, the round of 16. That third set, man, while it was happening, it was difficult to watch because she was clearly disengaged mentally. So people were calling it a tank. She said in press that she was suffering from cramps. Was there an injury? Was there a mental lapse? Like, I don't know. The thing is, we don't know what's going on with our favorite players. No matter how much you know about them or how much you care about them, we simply don't know. So many people wrote that off as a tank and absolutely slaughtered her on Twitter. You know, the worst are really her fans. They treat her the worst.
Well, not the worst.
But
clearly not the worst. But it just makes you wonder, what is the point of being a fan if you're this vicious to somebody who supposedly means so much to you?
Right. And I get it. I am a fan. I've been a fan for 2 decades, at least. I just don't know why you don't approach situations with...
Empathy?
Right. Like, it's as if some people approach these matches and take the least generous reading possible. Mm-hmm. And this is, like, your fave, right? So how do you treat people you don't like?
There is also a sense of her being... this is going to be so bad, but her worth being wrapped up in her winning. Mm. And if she's not winning, then she's not worth as much.
Right. Like, or I don't know if
that's the intent, but that's how it comes off.
And so I've dealt with this a little myself as a fan, thinking like, if she were having a blast, like if she were having fun and not winning, that's one thing. But there is something a bit labored about some of these tournaments for her, right? It doesn't always look like she's enjoying herself. Very often it looks like she's in agony and she's losing. So I get that, but like I wish people would come from it from a place of concern rather than really harsh judgment.
And I can't help but think that part of her agony is tied to that response. There is a correlation between the two.
Well, I don't know
so many members of her team are on Twitter.
Mm.
You know, some of that must seep back.
Regardless, it was alarming to watch that third set because for whatever reason, she was not engaged mentally. And it was a bloodbath.
She was emotionally and physically fried.
Yeah.
That was clear.
I mean, we knew from the first game that she was not winning.
The day before, she played the longest match that she'd played in almost a decade. In sweltering heat. Uh-huh. And she's now on the verge of turning 39. Coming back from a 5-month layoff due to a global pandemic. These are unusual circumstances that she finds herself in. But familiar to because she's been unable to close repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
So this confluence of events happen with her body and her mind betraying her as well. I don't think you can necessarily read into that as something to be worried about going forward, other than the state of her mental health in these tough situations. Because what was even more frustrating for her in that match, she comes in physically exhausted and then has big leads in both sets.
Mm.
Coughs mm-hmm. up the big lead in set one, is able to win it in a tiebreak. Then in the second set, she's up, what, 5-2 or 5-3?
You know, she served for the match. She served for the first set. Lost those.
Like... Exactly. And so she finds herself in a third set where she has nothing to give. And you could say maybe it was petulant. Maybe it was unprofessional. At certain points in her career, I'm sure Serena herself would say that that was a very unprofessional performance. But it is what it is
right.
at this point.
These pandemic tennis takes, it's too much. Honestly, I felt myself leaving that match saying, who cares? And like, if you're a fan of Serena and you're talking about, oh, she needs to be fine, da 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 da, like, really? Okay. Like, I cannot find myself getting that annoyed or angry about it because these are not normal circumstances. And to be quite frank, this is not the US Open. This is a makeshift Western and Southern Open that was kind of thrown together at the last minute. Serena's trying to get practice, and there's no week rest between this tournament and a major, which top players barely ever do. These are not normal circumstances.
Also, I always remind myself to resist the urge to moralize when it comes to athletes in sport.
Right.
It at this point would have to be an exceedingly egregious misstep or a repeated misstep from some man, which we see all the time.
When you say moralize, really, we will moralize about what people do off the court.
We will?
Don't we?
For example?
Like all the time? I'm sure on this episode we will.
Okay. I guess I could stand to be corrected at some point. Lord, this next bit, I'd even forgotten it happened.
I know. Diana Yastremska is coached by Sasha Bajin, as you know.
In case you're not familiar with them, I guess I'll moralize right off the bat.
I told you. Don't try to act superior.
You knew what was coming.
We have to keep each other honest.
Sasha Bajin, he who said that Europe does not have racism, doesn't mm-hmm. have a race problem. There's and that. And then his pupil, who then made her contribution to anti-black racism by painting half her face in blackface.
Yes. She of the half moon cookie.
Mm-hmm. Ebony and ivory, living in perfect half-facery.
So you may know that Ms. Yastremska has this earned reputation of being kind of the girl who cried wolf, right? She has retired down match point not once but twice in her very young career.
Mm-hmm.
She has the tendency to call the trainer.
She's been seen lobbying Congress for additional medical timeouts available to tennis players.
Mm-hmm. Renee Stubbs called her out on television this week, saying that her tactics belong in the juniors.
Mm-hmm. But this is the problem, though, with what Miss Yastremska does. She appeared to be legitimately injured,
like,
this time.
This week she was actually injured.
And this is what happens with the girl who cries wolf. Because when you actually need of assistance, when you actually need the medical timeout, who's going to be out here defending you?
Right.
And saying it's not gamesmanship?
I mean, you know, you'll get the medical timeout because that's the rules. But public opinion is not going to be with you because you've developed this reputation of your own doing.
And if you're one of those people who do what you want and don't care what other people think, go for it. But these two are not those people. Because Bayan is out here, after Yastremska loses, posting an Insta story where she's seen limping.
Mm-hmm.
Saying, so, she's not faking it.
It is bare stunts from these two.
And Diana
constantly.
Is very concerned about her public image on social media as well. There has to be a correlation between your own actions and what you expect to get from it.
Mm. Although, I will say that Diana does frequently like tweets that are critical of her.
Yeah,
she does. So maybe she has a good sense of humor. But this Twitter exchange was really par for the course for this coach-player pairing. They seem well-suited, right? So
Yastremska is playing Naomi Osaka,
who was previously coached by Sasha Bayan, of course.
She was.
And we know that the end of their relationship, it probably could have gone a little better. It's maybe not the most amicable between them. Sasha Bayan did write a book which featured some stuff about Naomi and which he published in Japanese, lest you think my stunt queen comment was overstated. It's stunts constantly, drama. And when drama follows one person, you have to start thinking, right? So Sasha tweets after the match, after Yastremska lost, congratulations to @NaomiOsaka, tagging her, and her team. She was the better player out there today, and good luck for the rest of the tournament. Okay.
Now, you'd think that this was the rumble in the jungle.
Well, absent of any context, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. It's actually very gracious, right? It's really nice and professional. But the fact that he tagged her and that this goes on is where it gets weird.
I want to know, has Naomi acknowledged him publicly at all?
I don't think so.
In the last year and a half?
I don't think so.
And so this continuous tagging, inserting himself into her business, this pick-me bullshit. I just learned what pick-me-ism is recently, and I think it's so great. People who need the attention on themselves all the time. It was astonishing.
Mm. So Diana tweeted back to Sasha, I always thought that I remain the best player on the court in your eyes, even if I lose. And I don't know, she could have been joking. For all I know, who knows? The whole thing is entertaining nonetheless.
I don't think she meant anything by it. I thought she was just trying to be cute.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like not really realizing the external context, all the subtext for this whole interaction.
And then Sasha writes back, of course you are. She was just better that day, and we will try to get her next time. It's like, meanwhile, Naomi is still being tagged in all of these weird tweets between the two. You know, you all could have had a text or in-person conversation that covered all of this. But mm-hmm. I mean, I appreciate the entertainment, so thank you for that.
Again, for me, this type of tweet happens after a big clash.
Yeah, this was, what, the second round of Cincinnati?
Like nobody was checking for it. Nobody was wondering what was going on. It was doing the most. And then all these players are, quote, tweeting it and laughing and liking it.
Amanda Anisimova, quote, tweeted it with LOL. And then Naomi liked her tweet. Girl, this is stuff you can't buy. I was saying earlier in the week that the Yastremska buy-in drama was too much. Like, it was just getting really tiresome, and it is, but I did really enjoy this, so thank you.
Now on to the segment of the show that most of you are probably here for, the part where tennis is being uprooted, potentially. A massive shift is happening in the governing structure of men's tennis.
Potentially.
And nobody really knows what's going on. And we suspect a lot of the players involved themselves don't really know what's going on, or at the very least, aren't able to articulate it very well.
Okay, talk about a Friday night news dump. This news came out on Friday evening that Djokovic, Pospisil, and Isner were resigning from the Players' Council to form this kind of breakaway Players' Association, which we now know as the Professional Tennis Players' Association.
PTPA.
This sounds suspiciously similar to the Association of Tennis Professionals, which is what the ATP stands for. It's basically the same words rearranged. So Djokovic and Pospisil distributed this document to players outlining their motives for forming this association and asking players to sign on and show their support. They cite the lack of bargaining power and influence that exists for players in the current ATP structure. And their intention is to create an association that represents the top 500 singles players and the top 200 doubles players. Just to remind you really quickly, the governance structure of the ATP is that there's a players' council that is made up of 10 players. We've heard from 9 of them so far. The only one we haven't heard from is Rendy Liu, who hasn't weighed in either way, which I thought was odd. The players' council elects player representatives to the ATP board of directors. So on the board of directors, there are 6 total board members. 3 of them are player representatives, 3 of them are tournament representatives, and then there's the CEO. The CEO currently is Andrea Gaudenzi, previously was Chris Kermode. So anyway, the Players Council discusses things, they elect the representatives to the board, they purportedly influence those board members to make decisions on their behalf.
And if you recall, for a while, Justin Gimelstob was the players' representative to the board.
Right.
So that player council of 10 players had elected Justin Gimelstob to represent them on the board of directors. And if you recall, at the end of last year, with everything going on, swirling around Justin Gimelstob with his cases that he caught, and the comeuppance that he had for his years of misogyny and now culminated with this physical assault, he was in line to replace Chris Kermode as CEO of the ATP. That was the goal of Djokovic and the Players' Council.
And before his personal life kind of blew up, that was a highly likely scenario. Mm-hmm.
And so when that fell by the wayside, they still went ahead and got rid of Kermode, and they put Andrea Gaudenzi in place as new CEO of the ATP. This is all very recent and presumably sanctioned by this group of players who are now breaking off.
Mm-hmm. Basically, the ATP is an organization that represents or attempts to represent both tournament and player interests under the same umbrella. So you have players and tournaments kind of at the same table in the structure. Historically, the ATP in the early 1970s was founded as a more of a player association, right? The ATP wasn't the tour itself as it is now. Like, there have been so many evolutions and iterations in men's tennis.
It was more of a union.
Basically, yeah. Djokovic and Pospisil feel that the current structure is not providing the players enough voice and enough leverage. And this new association, they hope, will, quote, provide players with a self-governance structure that is independent from the ATP and is directly responsive to player members' needs and concerns, end quote. You know, all of that is very interesting. This podcast has been covering this from the rumblings about a year and a half ago until this. And it feels very sudden because so much has happened over the past 24 hours, but this has truly been in the works for quite a while.
It has, but again, I'm caught off guard because we've been dealing with a pandemic whereby business is not as usual on the ATP and for the tennis governing bodies. All of them have been having to wheel and come again and come up with new ways of operating tennis, to get the tour started back again, to get money in the players' pockets while they aren't able to play. Nothing about the last 5 months is what you'd expect, or what they would have expected. Or if they had things on their agenda to get done, to implement new policies, to make changes, that stuff had to be put on the back burner because they've had to adjust to this new way of doing things. And this is not me sitting here defending the ATP and the ATP board of directors and saying, well, this is complete nonsense to have this PTPA started now. This is me trying to understand why now. You say that this has been in the works for a long time, but to my mind, at the end of last year, that was a reset. That there was some coming together to have a new collective way forward to at least give that some time to see how it would work. I want to know what has happened in the last 6 months, what hasn't happened for these players, for them to now take this, what I feel to be drastic step, given that everything seemed to be going in a different direction up until this weekend.
Well, that's the context, that Gaudenzi's first, say, half year in the role is quite unusual because of the pandemic, because of the stoppage of tennis. But I will counter that this wasn't exactly a reset, because the ATP and some members of the WTA were consulting with this law firm and issued that statement, when was that, before the Australian Open, demanding a greater revenue share and demanding basically an immediate increase in prize money. And people like Sloane Stephens and Vasek Pospisil were all on the same side on that. So the rumblings did not go away, even with their goal of ousting Chris Kermode.
We also had, if you remember, when this new ATP Players Council was formed, the last formation with new representatives, and Gaudenzi elected, Rafa and Roger came back to the fold.
Right.
So there was that change, and then at the start of the pandemic, Rafa and Roger let this cat out of the bag that, wow, wouldn't it be great if the tours merged?
So, yeah, we'll definitely get to that.
Yeah, this is all context, is what I'm saying.
So it's been an unusual 6 months for tennis. So Djokovic and Pospisil have installed themselves as co-presidents of this new association for 2 years, which just sort of made me laugh because that's not really how, you know, like the formation of a union typically works.
You said we can't say that
word. I know,
word.
It's not a union. So information has been coming out quickly through press conferences, through leaked letters and emails. And this evening, right before we went to record, a number of players who are on board with the new association tweeted this photo of a bunch of players all masked up on, that's Arthur Ashe Stadium, or?
I don't know which court it was. I wasn't paying attention to all that. Mm-hmm. I was just looking at who the players were, if I could identify them behind their masks.
Right.
I think it would be worthwhile to maybe point out a few of them that we could identify. Obviously, Djokovic and Pospisil were there. John Isner was there. Christian Garin was there. Félix Auger-Aliassime. Noah Rubin, I think, was there, which would be interesting given all that he's had to say about Djokovic in recent months. And also if Djokovic expects the prerequisite tight-lipped privacy in his meetings, I don't think he'll get that from Noah Rubin. Diego Schwartzman, which I couldn't really tell by the face, but by the body stature and stance, unmistakable. Mackie McDonald seemed to be there.
Right, but beyond that, we're not speculating who's in the photo. They're all wearing masks. Like, that's not really the point.
Listen, that's one of the few fun parts of all of this.
Okay, you can do that off the podcast. The point is that all of these guys, in the evening of Saturday, shared this photo and all used the same caption. After today's successful meeting, we are excited to announce the beginning of the Professional Tennis Players Association, the first player-only association in tennis since 1972. So Novak was able to expand a bit on the motivation for this in his press conference. There was only time for four questions in his post-tournament press conference because he spoke in treatises, not even in paragraphs. They've been advised by Norton Rose Fulbright, the law firm. The document that was spoken about in Rothenberg and Clary's New York Times piece, which came out on Friday, the document looked clearly that it was written or edited by labor lawyers, right? The language was very elevated, and they...
Wow.
No, but it was a bit legalistic.
Okay.
Not to, I mean, you can see the way Novak speaks is highly elevated. They're like, that's not a judgment on anyone's intelligence. Like,
it was just,
you know, clearly the document was drafted with some advisement from the law firm, in my opinion. But Novak said in his press conference that they have the legal right to form an association, and this is not a union. He said, this is a players' association, so we are not calling for boycotts. We are not forming parallel tours.
In your mind, why would someone go to that extent to make it clear that this is not a union?
Right. To me, I think they've been advised by this law firm that they've been consulting with that they may not have a clear legal right to unionization because they're independent contractors and they come from many different countries. And I don't know, but I think that the law firm probably advised them, you know, you can go ahead and create an association, no problem, but it's going to be a whole lot more complicated if you try to unionize.
Not only complicated, but I think there's a lot of ideological backlash against unions in this political climate. And I think that may be calculated. Now, if you're going with the approach that it's an association, you best have as many players on board as possible for it to be effective.
Mm-hmm.
For you to have any kind of political leverage within tennis. Otherwise, what are you doing? As it stands, there's no Roger, there's no Rafa, there's no Andy as yet. Andy says that he's not going to be signing a piece of paper today and that he is willing to give it time, but he also wants to know why the women aren't involved. If after this entire time since the start of the year, there's been so much talk and dialogue about the inclusion of men's and women's tennis as one entity, how are we at this place without any explanation as to why that hasn't happened or even any indication that it was considered? The name of the association, the PTPA, the Professional Tennis Players Association, doesn't say the Professional Men's Tennis Association. It's this default vernacular where neutral is assumed to be male, and it necessarily subjugates women.
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to, but in this case, there was clearly no effort to involve the women in the process. The ATP has hit back. Andrea Gaudenzi has said it's not a great idea, and we don't understand why you would want to give up your seat at the table as an insider and negotiate from the outside. Which, it's interesting because the governing structure in tennis is different from other major sports leagues. The ITF and the Grand Slams have also hit back and said, like, we don't support this at all.
It also isn't surprising that Gaudenzi would take this approach.
Well, this is...
He's new to this job. Mm-hmm. It's in his best interest to protect the interest of the company of which he is CEO.
Yes, this is an existential threat to the ATP, the way it exists now.
And you just shouldn't take everything he says at face value. You should interrogate it. When he says you have an equal seat at the table, we don't know that. There are three board members who represent the interests of the tournaments. There are three board members who represent the interests of the players. Do they get equal representation in practice? We know in theory they do, but in practice, do they? I mean, Novak gives the impression that they don't.
Right. And the conflicts of interest in tennis are so incredibly complex that there could be board members who have vested interests in different aspects of the sport. The other Players' Council members, Federer, Nadal, Querrey, Anderson, Melzer, and Suarez, not Lou, wrote an email that was shared by John Wertheim on Twitter and then many others, saying that they don't support this, that this is the wrong time, and that, quote, a new player association cannot coexist with the ATP, basically arguing that we need to give this new management time to follow through on what they're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. And this is in keeping with Gaudenzi saying that we will not recognize the PTPA.
Right. So there's a little bit of, you know, union busting from the ATP, which is expected. It's not a great look, but it's kind of what corporations do. But the Players' Council letter did ask a number of very good questions.
The Players' Council letter written by
the people who are left.
The dissidents.
Yes. And it highlighted that right now we have a lot more questions than we have answers. First of all, if I'm a player, why should I join this association? What am I risking by showing my support for the association? Are there bylaws? Is there a business plan? what are the very specific things you hope to accomplish in the short and long term?
Specifically, this letter had what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 bullet points with questions that they wanted clarification on and wanted the rest of the ATP players to consider before signing on to this PTPA. They state, "This document is so reliant on ATP still continuing to run the sport. This cannot happen. So what happens then? What happens if tournaments go against us?"
I don't know that I follow what's presupposed in that question. Why can the ATP not continue to operate tournaments? That's what they're arguing.
I think this is part of the unclear nature of what's going on. People are making arguments, vague arguments, with such certitude. And what exactly do you mean?
Yeah.
Why couldn't this lead to a new normal? They also ask, why do we not have a concise, analytical, detailed business plan of what is next? What is the best case, medium case, and worst case projections that we will make financially? Now, I thought this was very effective.
I thought this was less effective because a union or an association isn't required to draft a business plan. You know?
Sure, but if you're asking players to make this huge change, to be part of this huge shift in the way tennis is run, I would want more. Wouldn't you want to know this kind of stuff?
Oh yeah.
If one of the arguments, which we still don't know what the exact motivations are for this shift specifically, if one of the arguments is we need to be making more money, tell me how you're going to make that more money.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to see more money, and when should I expect it? I think that's reasonable. Can you give us a clear list of additional rights that this player association will provide us? What additional leverage do we have? What is a contingency plan to protect us if this goes ahead and badly?
So this is a good one. I think it gets to the heart of the matter. What additional leverage do we have? And this is very reliant on how many players sign up and who they are, right? So we know that Federer, Nadal, and Murray are not interested. But how does an association that exists outside of the ATP gain leverage? And we'll talk about this a bit later, but associations and unions gain leverage by the right to strike and the right to withdraw their labor as a tactic. They're independent contractors. They can withdraw their labor at any moment. It doesn't need an association.
Are they prepared somewhere down the road where a demand is not met and they then say, well, we have 300 players signed up. None of us is going to play the Australian Open. And will they go that route?
That's extremely powerful. But Djokovic said there will be no boycotts. So we shall see. There could be lockouts for all we know.
If the purpose is to represent the interest of all the players, why are there many players not included in this? Why are the player council not even asked? I find this strange.
Well, that I guess we can't speak to because that's a really insidery thing. That's inside baseball.
What happens to my ATP membership, ATP pension, ATP insurance, ATP entries?
Okay, fair enough. Another kind of employment question.
Who are the main people or experts that are advising you? I assume this could become very legal, and who is paying for this?
That's actually what I was wondering. Because they've been dealing with this law firm for a long time. Who's paying for it?
Who is taking responsibility for any fallout, both with our careers, income, and negativity? See, the negativity...
I like the negativity
the part. The negativity part seems like it's straight from the Fidel top.
Yeah, and that's a bit pointed. It feels a bit personal. I assume that a lot of players ranked a bit lower feel that they have less to lose and might be more willing to sign on to this thing. If you're a top player, it's like, why are you bothering me? If you're Federer and Nadal and you're so powerful that this doesn't really have an effect, you're probably like, can I just get on with my career and make money? But if you're, Matteo Berrettini, you're a top player, but you're not wealthy like those guys. So you may think, like, what do I stand to gain and what do I stand to lose? And I think that Novak's letter and what he's said so far isn't entirely satisfying because, you know, there are no bylaws. It's not really clear what this organization is intended to accomplish. What are the goals in the short term? How will you leverage this bargaining power? And those are all valid questions. And that doesn't have to invalidate a players' association, but these are things that should have been thought about before the association was formed.
Right. But if you're not a union, and if you're an association, and the ATP is an association, in name, how are you going to operate differently? What are your means of leverage? What are you trying to achieve? I've only heard vague things.
Yeah, I mean, we know vaguely what they want to achieve.
Which is what?
It's, you know, chief among it is better prize money. A better revenue sharing system that emulates other sports more closely. Things also, you know, I've seen the words like travel, insurance, communication. I don't know in reality what that stuff looks like, but an association can theoretically help you get those things if you have a big enough voice. It can create kind of a check and balance on the power of management. And the ATP, in my view, is very much management. To me, I don't buy players and tournaments existing in the same organization. I don't feel that it's equal. It's equal, like, in structure, technically, but philosophically, I think that the employer will always have a disproportionate level of power in that relationship.
Especially when livelihoods are tied to ranking points and prize money.
Yeah.
If you can always have that as a leverage hanging over a player's head in these negotiations where you're supposedly equal, that in itself makes it unequal. You don't come from the same starting point.
So I come from a place where I'm pro-labor in almost every situation, except for police unions, because those are not real unions. I really don't like the knee-jerk anti-labor reactions that I've been seeing from some people. The issue is you probably don't trust the leadership. You don't feel that they're sufficiently organized or that they've articulated their goals clearly enough. And that's valid. But to say that, like, the ATP has your best interest at heart, that doesn't really hold water for me.
And for Roger and Rafa to say that, it even more so doesn't hold water because they have the least to lose.
Well,
in this twilight of their power, right? Career, they're just as well off coasting along to the finish line with as few disturbances as possible.
Yeah.
Business as usual, as it's always been, is the path of least resistance. And to that end, I think it's a credit to Djokovic that he's willing to stir the pot. And if the genuine effort of this movement is to create more opportunities for players right down through the rankings, that he's willing to go in unforeseen ways to make it happen, potential kudos to him. But there are many issues that we should be keeping an eye on going forward. This is speculation, but we've always felt that Justin Gimelstob's excommunication from tennis would be short-lived. Like, we've already seen some attempts to rehabilitate his image, some of them led by himself, with like PR statements that he's put out on various news articles.
Some of them led by Novak Djokovic.
And I get the impression that when Novak and other players are saying this has been in the works for a very long time, if it's a very long time, Justin Gimelstob must have been involved because he hasn't been gone that long.
And I want to say that this is pure conjecture. Yeah. Because we haven't seen from a reputable source that he is or is not involved.
This can fall.
There's a lot of rumors.
This can fall on my head. Sure. You can get a new host if it becomes a problem for us. I'm just saying he's somebody that you may think would be gone from tennis for a long time, but just keep a lookout. And the other thing that's a huge issue for me is how in the hell can somebody who made a public living during the pandemic, creating these Tennis United videos, that someone being Vasek Pospisil now be heading this movement as co-president of the PTPA, and it absolutely excludes women.
And Vasek himself has said in the past that he's in favor of merging the tours. So I don't know where we are with that, but very clearly women are not part of this effort. They're not part of the photo. You know, like, now there's documentary evidence, there's iconography associated with this new organization, and it's all men. I just keep thinking about Billie Jean King talking about, like, imagine the bargaining power of having men and women in the same corner fighting for the same things or similar things. Imagine what kind of leverage that would create.
We do know that one of the straws that probably broke the camel's back was Naomi Osaka's withdrawal and the fallout that ensued from that,
mm-hmm.
whereby the men felt that they were not consulted of having this pause in play, that these decisions were made by the tournament, by both tours, but the players' council and the players weren't consulted.
Yeah, so this is not a good look.
It is not.
Because there have been... So first there were rumors, and now it's confirmed that some of these guys were not pleased that they were not consulted about this stoppage in play as a result of Naomi's direct action. Now, Naomi didn't say, like, guys, you can't play. I'm stealing a day of rest from you before the U.S. Open. That was not it, right? Like, she did something for her to make a statement.
She, quote-unquote, inconvenienced four male players. Four.
She sure did.
One of which was Novak Djokovic.
So, yeah. So now we know that one or several were pissed about it. And the fact that this association drive sprung up in the wake of that, it's not a good look. It's not cute. It doesn't feel like liberation to me.
They've hired lawyers. Perhaps they should have hired a PR firm. Because what are the optics?
Well,
with so much talk about unity coming together and the tours working together from March, so much talk. They've been asked about impressors a lot. People have been given statements for months, and you couldn't foresee that coming out with this PTPA excluding women, not even seemingly considering women, this photo op that borrows from the original nine, this theft of imagery, iconography to create your own master Mr. Brand. Like, how did this pass through the checkpoints? And to then have it announced on the back of this momentous day, not just for Naomi, but for tennis, this moment of unity in tennis, to then take the chance that your new association might be tainted by your spilled male tears. That is crazy to me.
So one of the other issues kind of floating around this has been the resistance to pandemic health and safety protocols. We know a lot of players were disgusted about Delian and Pela being expelled from the Cincinnati tournament because their physio tested positive. And it's so interesting that a lot of players become politically active for a reason as stupid as this. Most unions, maybe not in sports, but most unions are fighting for more serious health and safety policies and procedures from management.
Not to have them removed.
Like, they're trying to... The only reason, really, that we have OSHA or the Health and Safety Acts in Canada and the Workplace Safety Insurance Board, Workers' Compensation, etc., are because unions fought and because people were injured and died on the job, right? But unions fought for more rigorous health and safety protocols in the workplace. Like, that's a fact. So it, to me, it's like, it's not that cute to see this purported association / union fight for more lax health and safety protocols.
This after we know that they were particularly upset about the requirement to quarantine returning from the US Open to Europe to play the clay swing. These men are not scientists.
Mm-hmm.
They're not biologists. They're not virologists. So for you to be making those demands to lessen the safety protocols put in place to protect not just you, but everybody involved in the sport, the players, the staff, the executives aren't on site, it turns out.
That's actually something we forgot to mention.
Yeah. Point is,
mm-hmm.
you want to take away all these protections to make things a little bit easier for you. I say this leading up to, we can surmise that maybe Djokovic was annoyed by the Osaka thing, given that he was one of four players affected directly. Mm-hmm. We can surmise that he was one of the players annoyed by the quarantining issue back in Europe. Possibly because he's already had COVID. Possibly because he's one of the players who will be doing both. And so is he making demands from a perspective of personal comfort? Or is he making it from a place of concern for the general good of the rest of the players? It could be a bit of both, and there could be overlap in certain areas, but when you say that your perspectives and your proposals potentially aren't getting enough light or time of day within the current structure, Is it just that maybe your demands aren't good ones?
I know, like, it sounds flippant, but, you know, if you're someone who's pro-labor, but workers come together to form a union and they put forward just really bad ideas, what do you do? And I don't even want to get into the personal side of this. Looking at John Isner as someone who holds far-right political beliefs is not typically someone you look at as someone who's fighting for collective bargaining rights. Djokovic, over the past 6 months, how his reputation has suffered because of how he has navigated the quarantine. You know, if this is the leader that the association has chosen, then he is the right guy for the job. But is he the right guy for the job?
A lot of unanswered questions. A lot of speculation. You might not like a lot of the speculation, but, like, this is where we are.
I think overall, just really quickly to wrap it up, is that unions are generally a force for good and can secure really important strides for workers. You know, same goes for an association or a professional guild like this. If this is what's going to come from it, we need to just continue to ask these questions. And, you know, something we haven't mentioned, at the end of the day, this isn't any of our business, really. Like, this is not our job. These are tennis players who can decide their own fates. It's their jobs, not ours, that are on the line.
It is our job to hold their feet to the fire when it comes to excluding women, though.
Yes. But overall, this is their livelihood, and they have the autonomy to decide how they want it to go.
If you came for a long, expansive preview of the US Open and its draws, then you will be disappointed, because we simply cannot do that at the moment. We do not have the bandwidth.
Right, this would typically comprise an entire episode. The majors only happen 4 times a year. This year, only 3 times, but they're a pretty big deal in body serve land. But we're going to have to compress this US Open preview, because this is a unique tournament and a lot of other stuff is happening right now.
We can tell you with certitude that we have no idea who will be winning. You seem to think that Djokovic will be winning the US Open. I don't think it is as certain as you would have us believe. And on the women's side, well.
Anyone out of 128, I would believe.
If I was going to say somebody you could eliminate is Angelique Kerber, but even then, I can't even go that far.
Wow. You really eliminated a seeded 3-time major winner.
Yeah, because, like, she hasn't played any competitive tennis, really.
Okay, fine. Karolina Plíšková is the number one seed. She's the number 3 ranked player right now. The withdrawals are crazy. They've really changed the way that the seedings work. Some players you may not be familiar with are seeded this year.
I think you can look to the players who've played in the lead up to the US Open and who've done well as players to watch.
Right. You can only make predictions based on past performance, right? And recent past performance. Plíšková is the number one seed, but she really did not have a great match this week.
She seems to struggle with fast courts. And apparently, the courts at the Billie Jean King Tennis Center are playing pretty fast this year.
Right. She could face Jennifer Brady, the 28 seed, in her third round. Brady, as you know, just won Lexington. If you're not feeling that confident, that's just not a player you'd like to face in the third round.
You're probably wanting to know what are the early round matchups to look for. I've marked out a couple here. Angelique Kerber, why I'm not as bullish on her, not just for her lack of match play, but because she draws Ayla Tomljanovic in the first round. Mladenovic gets wildcard young American Haley Baptiste. Naomi Osaka plays fellow Japanese player Misaki Doi in the first round, provided Naomi's healthy and recovered from that hamstring issue that she picked up in the semifinals of Cincinnati. Sevastova plays Coco Gauff in the first round. Should Gauff get past that, she gets Kazatkina in the second round. And then, potentially, we have another meeting between Naomi Osaka and Coco Gauff in the third round.
This would be their third meeting in as many majors in the third round. And they've split the first two.
Danielle Collins plays Anett Kontaveit. Jessica Pegula plays Marie Boskova. Two of the hottest players since the resumption.
Yeah, both unseeded. That's really unlucky for both of them, because I think they each had a shot of going pretty deep.
One I really want to watch, Vera Zvonareva against Leyla Fernandez. Alexandrova gets Kim Clijsters in the first round. Clijsters would then be on course to play Elisa Mertens in the third round. Mertens herself gets Laura Siegemund in the first round. Venus Williams draws Karolina Muchova in the first round. Should Venus get through that, in the second round she'd play either Stojanovic or Kalinskaya, and then potentially Johanna Konta in the third round. Victoria Azarenka, back from the tennis dead. In the first round she gets Barbara Haas, before potentially an all-Belarusian second-round matchup between herself and Sabalenka. Serena draws Kristi Ahn. Her second round would be Monica Puig or Gasparian. A third round potentially against Sloane Stephens. And then a rematch of her wild, just wild Cincinnati match against Maria Sakkari. And then in the first round, we also have Dana Vekic playing Kristina Pliskova.
Right, so I have big question marks in the first quarter and the fourth quarter of the women's draw. The first quarter is Pliskova's as the number one seed. Does she reach the semifinals? And if she doesn't, who the hell does? Is it Brady, Kerber, Vondrousova, Mladenovic, Martic? I mean, you could have a totally shocking semifinalist. The second quarter clearly should be Naomi Osaka if she's healthy, because she was playing quite well in Cincinnati.
Or Anett Kontaveit.
Kontaveit, you have Elena Rybakina, who was having an incredible year before the quarantine, who could face Diana Yastremska in the third round. And they've had, I would say, like a similar career trajectory as young players. The fourth quarter is interesting because Vika Azarenka could feasibly make the semifinals. The title list in Cincinnati, but there's Venus, there's Aryna Sabalenka, who is the number five seed. I mean, it is no easy task to take out Sabalenka just in the second round. And we have seen players on a roll or coming off a big title lose very early in majors. Iga Świątek is in there, Joanna Konta, who is great on a fast surface. Mertens, Kenin is a big question mark because she didn't really have a great showing recently. On Shabur,
I've seen people filling out their brackets on Twitter, and under regular circumstances, under normally scheduled programming, you would be laughing, howling at the winners and the semifinalists, but not one of them was unrealistic this year.
Honestly, whoever you pick, I'm not even going to criticize it, because who knows? I haven't bothered making my own brackets because this year is just so unpredictable.
Serena's chances?
Serena did not get a bad draw, if we're making predictions, right? Her first round, her second round, the third. I'm not trying to pile on Sloane here, but if you're getting a third round seeded opponent, Sloane is kind of the one you want. And she may not even make it there.
See, I disagree. If Sloane gets to the third round, she's exactly the type of person you do not want to play, because she's so unpredictable.
Right, but like, when is... Never mind. I'm not going to go into that. But Sloane is just not reliable to get there, quite frankly.
You're playing with fire, making that argument at a Grand Slam. Okay, just do it.
Jill Teichman is, aside from Venus, probably on an equal plane, the most dangerous floater. Well, and Coco Gauff. Jill Teichman is unseeded. She could face Madison Keys in the second round. And Madison, man, she just had a bleak showing against Ons Jabeur at the Western Southern Open.
Speaking of, Ons is somebody that you should be looking at.
Yeah. She's in a more crowded area of the draw.
Jennifer Brady, Teichman, Ons Jabeur.
Muguruza reached a hardcourt major final this year. You know, there are only two of them, Kenin and Muguruza, who have reached finals at the Australian Open.
I asked you about Serena's chances.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, she got match play, which is what she was looking for in Lexington and Cincinnati. Clearly, there's a question mark about the Sakkari match. And of course, she could face Sakkari again in the fourth round. But I don't know. No predictions, but the draw could definitely be much, much worse.
Nobody's made more slam finals than Serena has in the last 2 years. That's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
She's older now, fine. You may be concerned about her play in the smaller events at Kentucky, at Cincinnati, the way she went out. However, she got the match play. She was playing in back-to-back situations. Slams are not like that. unless you have serious weather interruptions, especially now with the roofs at that tennis center. So presumably she'll be able to play on every other day.
Yeah.
I think that more than most benefits her at this tournament. Mm-hmm.
On the men's side, I know that I already said that Novak is winning this, which takes a little bit of the suspense out of it. But, I mean, there are some hurdles in his quarter. John Isner in the fourth round, potentially Riley Opelka or maybe Denis Shapovalov in the quarters. But I think Novak has a clear shot to the semis and probably the win.
You're just completely overlooking David Goffin in the first round. Yeah. Opelka plays Goffin in the first round.
I know. So that's a question mark. Does Goffin get out of the first round? Because Opelka is just coming off that quarterfinal run in Cincinnati. He did retire against Tsitsipas.
Best of five in the heat for a guy as big as him might be still too much for him at this stage of his career.
Right. We shall see.
Matches I'm looking forward to, the aforementioned Opelka-Goffin match. Kevin Anderson plays Alexander Zverev in the first round. That is a tall order.
Yikes.
For both players.
Literally tall.
Pun intended.
Mm-hmm. Kevin Anderson, the Gerald Ford of the Players Council.
Do you want to explain that? We have an international audience. Yes.
The Selena, what was her name?
Selena Meyer.
The Selena Meyer of the Players Council. Kevin Anderson is the current vice president of the Players Council, with the president unable to fulfill his duties due to resignation. Does Kevin Anderson assume the role of president, as did Gerald Ford?
Oh my God. Thiago Zajbuch-Vuj plays Dan Evans in the first round. If you recall, Thiago was the first tennis player to test positive for COVID-19 at the start of all this mess.
Mm-hmm.
And he was having a good year up until that point. So it'll be interesting to see how he turns up in New York. Dan Evans, for his part, a much maligned character in tennis.
Dan Evans can be relied upon to share the unvarnished truth, for better or for
his
worse.
His unvarnished truth.
Yeah.
And today his unvarnished truth was that he was not going to be signing that paper.
Right.
Karen Khachanov plays Jannik Sinner in the first round. And that's all I got for first round matchups. I found the men's side much more dull when it came to early round matches.
Oh, I disagree. RBA versus Sandgren. I mean, that's certainly not what I'm going to watch.
Sure, but then you have to watch it.
Right. Pospisil and Cole Schreiber. Cole Schreiber is a classic spoiler.
But what is he spoiling? The world number 90-something? Like, I don't understand.
The new co-president of the Players Association. Tiafoe and Seppi. John Millman and the alleged abuser, Basilashvili. Notice I said alleged there. And Grigor Dimitrov and Tommy Paul. Grigor is someone we're watching because he has actually been honest about the difficulty he's had in recovering from COVID and kind of reaching that peak athletic level.
Two of the standouts from this past week in Cincinnati, Roberta Bautista Agut and Miloš Raonic, are on course to meet in the third round. That sucks for them.
Yes.
It's clear now that Roberto is a thorn for Novak. He beat mm-hmm. him twice last year. He pushed him to three sets in the Cincinnati semifinals. And he's on the opposite side of the draw. They would only meet in the finals.
Right.
The other person who could be the biggest thorn for Novak is Daniil Medvedev. He too is on the bottom half of the draw, in opposite quarters from Bautista Agut. So they would play in the semifinals. And Bautista took him out in Cincinnati. Medvedev sped to a 5-1 lead in that first set in no time. And Roberto was able to win the last two sets.
Medvedev was the defending champion in Cincinnati. He was a runner-up at the US Open last year. In order to get to the final again, he might have to go through Berrettini. Could be Andrei Rublev in that quarter. In the fourth quarter, we could see Dominic Thiem. A lot of people predicted Dominic Thiem to be in possibly the best form of anyone aside from Novak, but his performance in Cincinnati was a bit perplexing because of how much he's played.
I overlooked Andy Murray and Yoshihito Nishioka as a first-round match to watch. And should Andy get through that, he would get, likely, Felix in the second round. That would be a must-watch.
Yes. And after that, he could face, if he beat Felix, Dan Evans, who I know a lot of Andy fans are hoping that Andy reasserts his dominance as the British number one. But Dan Evans is the clear British number one at the moment.
We'd love to see a good deep performance from Andrei Rublev. He is a fave in this house.
Mm-hmm.
As the round of 16s stack up, Novak would play Isner, Shapovalov would play Goffin, Tsitsipas playing Garin, Schwartzman against Zverev in the top half of the draw. In the bottom half, Berrettini plays Rublev, Dimitrov plays Medvedev, Bautista Agut against Khachanov, and then Felix against Dominic Thiem. If the seeds were to all make it to the round of 16, that's how it would work out. I suspect maybe five of them will make it. Truly, there's no point spending a whole lot of time on the US Open draws. If there was ever a slam for us to shirk this responsibility, this is the one to do it. Because there is absolutely no point. Everything we've seen from the tennis so far has been unpredictable. Right. Except for the players who were playing well before the stoppage. Especially on the women's side. And Novak, who's now 23-0 on the year.
It's impressive that anyone was able to sustain that momentum throughout this huge break, Novak included. But going forward, especially on the men's side, going into best of five sets, there is no point in making predictions. I think we just hope that everyone remains healthy and safe, which is a tall order this pandemic.
We've seen folks have struggled with even the best of three format upon resumption, let alone having to play best of five on the men's side in this type of heat. Not to get too Ben Rothenberg about it. But, you know, it is a legit concern for these players. You can't even say those who are more physically conditioned or physically fit would have an advantage because you still need the match play.
Yeah.
It'll be a mental exercise this next fortnight for these players with no fans in attendance, with the line calling different. What did you make of the live Hawkeye? Live?
Honestly, I don't really care about that.
Okay.
There's only so many things that I can care about at one time. I would say that it's really, really funny when Hawkeye says stop, and overrules itself, I guess.
What was delicious was when Hawkeye called footfalls on Diana Yastremska on match point.
Second serve, match point, the footfall ended the match for her. And that actually brought up an interesting discussion between us. And that we've never seen this in real life. And I argued that no human being would ever make that call on match point. You know, someone brought up the Serena thing, but that was the point before match point when the footfall was called. I think that humans are so fallible that no one would be that confident to make that call to alter the end of the match.
But also you don't get to match point until it's match point. So you could say that Serena's was the point before match point, but had that footfall not happened, it may never have gotten there. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So it really is unforeseen that this happened. And you're right. Who would have made that call unless it's a type of call that unless it's an egregious footfall, you're just not going to see it.
Yeah. I will say, I think we've seen a lot more footfall calls with the electronic line calling. I think the computer just noticed it more frequently than normal.
Mm-hmm. Right? It puts into relief just how subjective a lot of the officiating is in tennis and the enforcement of rules. A lot of context and subtext that you can read into that. Have at it in your spare time. On that note, thanks for listening. There was a lot to unpack in this episode. We hope we were helpful in some regard. You're going to be hearing from us more often than normal, than we've been around in the last few months because of this Slam Tennis. We will likely have a mid-US Open episode as well as a US Open wrap episode. If you've enjoyed the show, this one, or any of the previous ones in quarantine, if you're a new listener, if you've recently discovered us, one of the ways that you can show your appreciation is by giving us a review on iTunes or any of the podcast apps that you use. Those are much appreciated. Again, it's one of the ways that you can help us, that you can tangibly help us build the profile of the show.
I am James at ElliotJMR on Twitter.
Two L's, two T's. My name is Jonathan at tennis_John.
We are at The Body Serve on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
I learned today that if you use Overcast, which apparently is an Apple only, an iOS only app, they have a function built in where you can make your own snippets of the show and share them on social media.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I do not encourage you to snippet things that you hated that we said and blast us on the internet.
Well, you're really asking.
Because we know your mama taught you better than that. But if there is something that you enjoyed, you can also help us build a profile of the show by, you know, sharing some of the laughs that you enjoyed. Mm-hmm. Snip them if you use Overcast and let us know. Thanks for listening. Till next time.
Thank you very much.